to you again. You are our most faithful viewer. We have one spectator that always appears to the appointment. Thank you very much for being there. Adrian, nice to see you for the first time. And I hope that Anthony also comes on. There is another student that became the first one to speak. I think she left for afterwards. So recapping what I was saying, I'm just coming to a general conclusion. I'll probably move the monitor so you guys can see me when I move around. I tried to speak very loud, but if I don't get any moments, please tell me if you can't hear me. What I was saying before, post-structuralism is a natural way of reaching a critical point of view that wants to change the perspective of literary criticism, because literature was already being very experimental. So it made sense that critical theory was also experimental. What things are going to be challenged in literary theory? The same things that are challenged in society. The first thing that we're going to challenge is the importance of authority. The importance of authority in the literary point of view of the author. The importance of the narrative. Is there one side of the story? We're going to challenge history. This is what we're going to do in the second unit. In the second unit, we're challenging one of the pillars of society, the narrative of the story. Right now, I don't have to tell you what a big dispute there is between the media in the central part of Spain and one of the regions of Spain, between getting the narrative to move in one direction or getting the narrative in the other direction. Are only the Catalonian independentist journalists right about things? Are only the people that are very critical with the political situation in Catalonia right about the situation? Probably the truth lies somewhere in the middle. I don't know closer to which side. But what literary theory says about this, and I'm not going to go into politics, of course not, is that narrative is always an account of the winning party. The winning party gets to tell the story. So if the Romans talk about Julius Caesar's triumphant campaign, they will probably admit that there were rapings or that they stole the gold of such tribe or such other victory was a lot bloodier and less glorious than they had in the day initially count on the stories. So one of the things that historicism is going to do, new historicism, is to challenge the historical facts of the events and to look at history with a new perspective. Okay? To challenge what if we told the story from the point of view of the Vietnamese instead of the Americans, about the word Vietnam. That's the poem that we're going to read for the second unit. 12 o'clock news by Elizabeth Bishop. That's a challenge that you have for the following week. Are we going to stop here? Of course not. The society, what is the biggest criticism that you hear about society? Nowadays, the biggest, I would say social group that has leverage over the facts of life are the feminists. The feminists are complaining about the patronizing tendencies of society, about how the point of view is normally masculine. It's normally, it normally creates a narrative of what a decent woman has to be, but it doesn't create a narrative of what a decent man has to be. It focuses the attention on women exclusively because it is taking into consideration sex as a relationship of superiors and inferiors. So the next thing that is going to be questioned is a patriarchal society. Is feminism. Doesn't make a lot of sense for a guy to teach you feminism, but well, we're going to have to work around that. In the case of this topic, I think that all of you have a feeling that feminism, and you're right, to a certain extent, that feminism is something that is very fresh, very current. But this is a war that has been fought for decades. The beginning of feminism, it stems back to the late 60s. So what we're talking about here is post-structuralism, 50s, historicism, 60s, feminism, late 60s, 70s. So we know that we're going to go into the 80s. What are the other social struggles, the other social strikes? As you can see, this is probably the only moment while you're studying English studies that you're going to connect social problems to literature in such a direct and raw way. The other ways are to study, for example, racial inequality, racial injustice. Why do we always talk from the point of view of Western culture, Western civilization? We become exotic to everything that isn't in Rome or in Paris or in New York or in Berlin. So we take the world as if it was Eurocentric. We seem to deny Galileo's discoveries and Copernican discovery, and we tend to believe that the whole universe revolves around certain places that are either in Europe or in North America. From that point of view, it's taking the racial and the colonial struggle, and we're going to talk about, for example, slavery. And we're going to talk about post-colonialism. Post-colonialism, racial inequality. Racial inequality in this book in particular is halfway in feminism because imagine if it's difficult to succeed as a woman in society, how difficult it would be to succeed as a black woman in society. How difficult must it be to succeed in life as a black lesbian woman in life? So the other big killer, and we end up destroying all of the killers of Western society, is sexual liberation. And here we absolutely have to LGTB. I don't know how long this acronym is. I tend to get lost. And we tend to talk about queer theory, and it's about the rights of the lesbians, the gays, bisexuals, the transsexuals, people that have fluid sexuality, all the different sexualities that used to be queer. And this takes us to the beginning, to structuralism. Queer means curioso, raro. So the first word that was invented to refer to people that were not heterosexual was to, again, place this dichotomic point of view. There's always one that is good and one that is bad. And it's not a coincidence that for good we use white and for bad we use black. Because it takes us here. But we normally call straight people heterosexual. What is not straight? Everything that is deviant. So we select the negative parts of our language to talk about everything that isn't the established form that has been been transferred from generation to generation from very long ago in time by an authorial core that is heterocentric, extremely sexist, patriarchal, only interested in the success of the Western civilization. So taken to the extreme, all of these theories that we're studying here are theories that challenge elements of society. And I think you have to walk away at the end of this course. I think that's the biggest lesson that you have to walk away. Of course, you have to learn a few literary terms to put it in practice. But this is what this subject intends for you to learn. They want you to think about the possibility that there is always a bias whenever you're reading a story. Whenever you're reading a story, there's a there is an agenda or something that is preconceived by society, and normally we're going to prefer princesses to witches. We're going, just the fact of having princes and witches and not having a counterpart for men indicates how sexist the stories of princesses and witches or the mythology of princesses and witches are. It's very difficult to walk away from all of these constraints of society without falling into one, even when you give examples. So, that's the core of the course. We are in this first part where we're questioning authority. We're questioning the biggest authority in the literary text, the author. And we're questioning the second authority in literary text, the literary critic, the traditional literary critic that establishes a word that is called the canon. The canon means the cool ones, the ones you have to love. You have to love Shakespeare. You can't hate Shakespeare. It's, well, it's true. You can't hate Shakespeare. It's cool. But you have to read Beowulf and love it. You have to read Chaucer and understand it and love it. It's very stuff there. You have to appreciate Cervantes. You have to appreciate Daniel Defoe. You have, there is a set of books that are all coincidentally based on European or Western standards, written by European or Western writers about European or Western topics. So you can only be interested in a set of things that is very limited regarding the total population of the world. For example, we are focusing on a portion of society, of the entire population of the world that is probably, I don't know, 10% of the population at most. So this is the first that post-structuralism wants to eliminate. They want to eliminate the idea that there is a canon, the idea that there is one single interpretation to every story. And there are many ways of approaching this, but in the case of this course, we're going to approach it from a post-structuralist point of view. You can download this presentation. It's available in the class forum. I don't know if you access. I've already posted links to the two previous recordings and to this presentation. Angela, you got a phone, and maybe sometimes the volume is a bit low, and maybe with headphones you can say that. Basically, what I do is I bring structuralism and I compare it to post-structuralism. You need this knowledge for the exam. No, you don't. You don't need to know anything about structuralism. It's not expected. I just use it as an introductory term because I find it very difficult to explain something post before explaining the pre. So I just use it as a point of introduction. But don't worry if you don't grasp all these concepts of structuralism and post-structuralism. I think the most important thing for you is to understand it when you read it, not so much to memorize it. What you do have to understand is are the contents that come in the study guide. This is what you're going to have to know to answer in the exams. From the point of view of post-structuralism's main figures, we have three figures. We have Roland Barthes. We already read the other day his Death of the Author, and his work where he stops being a structuralist and he becomes a post-structuralist. Jacques Derrida, we're going to read today to close Unit 1 from his work of grammatology. And Barbara Johnson, who is a critical author that provides the biggest amount of framework for the deconstructive process. As you will probably notice, all of these theories are flawed in one way or the other, because when a theory is extremely radical, as with politics or as anything in life, it tends to be polarizing more than inclusive. So the more extremist one of these theories is, the easier it is to find cracks and things that you don't agree with, and creases that you don't fully understand. You think, well, this is a bit artificial, this analysis. From the point of view of deconstruction, it's probably the most useful tool for post-structuralism, and this is probably what we're going to walk away with towards the rest of the theories. All the rest of the theories are going to have that deconstructive point of view when analyzing text. When feminism, for example, analyzes a text, it's going to deconstruct a traditional text and exemplify what cases of patriarchal behavior are obvious in, for example, Hamlet. Why are Shakespeare's works always about male heroes, and why are women always subjugated to secondary roles, roles that are tragic, that end in death, or that end in a person being used to marry, or to gain a favor, or to work as a backdrop, and they are never the key role of the story. That type of analysis, is going to be relevant moving forward in other theories. Her deconstructive point of view is not exactly the same as other post-structuralists, and she includes a feminist theory in her deconstructive point of view. And even psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis is normally very controversial in the school of thought. And when we get to feminism, for example, we'll see how not everyone agrees with the necessity of using psychoanalysis in literary theory, because it's not a fully accepted theory. Freudian theory is not fully accepted. This virtual course works in a different way than the other one. Regarding the guide, what you should do is read through the contents of the guide. The guide is normally very short. It just says, take various book or read from this page to that page. The page numbers, I think, are from the third edition, so they might not be accurate. Pay attention to that. And we read the other day, Roland Barthes, the Deputy Author. We're going to read from page 7 of the guide, the last page of Grammatology. That's what we're going to do. We're going to try to address some of the questions. I'm going to introduce you to the answers to these questions. So first, you try to come to a meeting by yourself. For example, I want us to focus on question number 5, just to give us one that is easier to connect to the text of Roland Barthes. You have this. This is downloaded from the virtual course. It's a PDF file, and for every unit, you have at least 2 PDF files. In unit 1, that's why I brought them and printed out. That's the last day I read them from the title. And for every unit, you have a guide. It's normally short. This one is 8 pages, and it comes with questions, and there's a separate answer booklet that it has suggested answers for these questions. Why are these questions relevant? This is the structure of the questions you're going to be asked in the exam. If you get used to this, if you find a sense in the answers that are provided, you're good to go and you're ready for the PEC, which is very similar to the exam. I totally recommend you do the PEC because it counts towards the final mark, and in second place, because it prepares you very well for the exam. Everything that you do for the PEC is work in the best of doing for the exam. The PEC is normally due first week of December, if I'm not mistaken. And they, in this subject in particular, they normally publish the date very close to when it's supposed to be submitted. So I would expect it to be published by mid-November. Okay, so if it's not just tell me so I can talk to Isabel and to Lucia from the people of the Fortress. Regarding this, we've covered all of this material that comes with a deconstructionist view of the more of the death by fire in the Tower of London, which is also in the beginning theory. So this first poem is not necessary. In Unit 2, on the other hand, we have, and I brought Unit 2 also, because we're started, and I'm going to go to the camera, because I'm doing all this in front of everybody else, but not for the three people that are at home. We have a study guide for Unit 2. You should download and print this out. And then you have the answers to Unit 2, regarding new historicism and cultural materialism. And afterwards, there are a set of documents that are also available. The first one of them is the text of 12 o'clock news. You can find that in many places. There's a link to Elizabeth Bishop's poems at the beginning of the virtual course. And you also have a critical assessment, which is the poem itself. You can see how weird it looks. It's not a traditional poem. It has like, it looks like a definition. And there's like two columns in this poem. So it's an unusual poem, very modernist. And afterwards, a document about the war, the Vietnam War. You'll see why it's relevant afterwards. I have an extra copy of this one. And those are the four documents that you need for this unit, okay? Have you printed that out?
Yes.
But you haven't done that, right?
No.
Okay. So that's what you need for this unit. So in this one, you haven't? Okay. So, and maybe we can.
I already have the unit 2.
No, we have unit 2, okay. Well, you didn't read it.
Yes.
I read it. Okay. So anyway, since I'm going to read it, you're okay. This is a moment, only moment where you can not text and pay attention, okay? This is from Jack's area. We talked about the relevant author. We say that Roland Barthes is a seminal author because he represents the transition from structuralism to post-structuralism. He started his life as a structuralist, then he realized that actually structuralism was a constraining theory, and he moved on to post-structuralism. His work, Death of an Author, is considered the most important, Death of the Author, not an author, is considered the most important work of post-structuralism. But Jacques Derrida, the work of Grammatology, is considered the initial work, foundational work of post-structuralism. So it's also very relevant. And I think that it's going to give us some ideas that connect Roland Barthes, Jacques Derrida, and the rest of what I explained about post-structuralism, and I hope we picked up some concepts. Jacques Derrida. The writer writes in a language and in logic whose proper systems, laws, and life, his discourse by definition cannot dominate absolutely. He uses them only by letting himself be governed by the system, and the reader must always aim at a certain relationship, unperceived by the writer, between what he commands and what he does not command of the patterns of the language that he uses. So it's all about how unreliable either the language is or the use of languages. This relationship is a signifying structure that critical reading should produce. What does produce mean here? In my attempt to explain that I would initiate a justification of my principles of reading, to produce this signifying structure obviously cannot consist of reproducing by the effaced and respectful doubling of commentary the conscious, voluntary, intentional relationship that the writer institutes in his exchange with the history to which he belongs, thanks to the element of the language. What Derrida is saying basically is that works and authors do not exist in isolation. Works and authors have a history around them and a language around them that limits and that influences their work. Postmodernist work is postmodernist because before postmodernism, It was influenced by modernism when the author was growing up reading modernist book or Renaissance book or realist book or romantic books. Literary works and authors do not live in isolation. They're surrounded by their history, by their personal circumstances, by whatever was written before them, and also by the language itself. And that's what Derrida is expressing in this writing. This type of commentary should no doubt have its place in a critical reading. Yet, if reading must not be content with doubling the text, it cannot legitimately transgress the text towards something other than itself, towards a reference, a reality that is metaphysical, historical, psychobiographical, or towards a signified outside the text whose content could have taken place outside of the language. That is to say, outside of writing in general. We propose the absence of the referent, of the transcendental signified. There is nothing outside the text. There is no outside text. There has never been anything but writing. Although it is not commentary, our reading must be intrinsic and remain within the text. Yet, there are interpretations that take us outside of the writing towards a psychobiographical signified, or even towards a general psychological structure that can be separated from the signifier. As you can see, Derrida is not the most exciting writer you can read. It seems to us, in principle, impossible to separate from interpretation or commentary the signified from the signifier. Here we must take into account the history of the text in general. When we speak of the writer and the encompassing power of language to which he is subject, we are not only thinking of the writer in literature, we are thinking of the philosopher, the chronicler, the theoretician in general, and everyone writing. But in each case, the person writing is inscribed in a determined textual way. A philosophical text, although it is in fact always written, includes precisely as its philosophical specificity the project of effacing itself in the face of signified contents which it transports and in general teaches. Reading, it should be aware of this project, the entire history of text, and within it, the history of literary forms of the West should be studied from this point of view. Literary writing has almost always and almost everywhere, according to some fashions, and across very diverse age, lent itself to its transcendent reading. Transcendent means that there is a universal signification in reading, and that's what's being challenged by post-structuralism at its core. That search for the signified, which we put in question, not to annul it, but to understand it within a system to which such a reader is blind. I want you, you're in Paris, for example, you can discuss that for a minute. Stop to think of question number 5. What do you think Derrida means when he writes, there is nothing outside the text? I want to give you 1 minute to talk about that, and I want your best answer. But in English, when I talk about this, it's not the way it works.
Hello, Angela, how are you? Maybe you can type your answer. I want to know the answer. To questions 4 and 5. 1 second, Andrea. Of Derrida's text. Okay, just type your answer, what you think could be a possible answer. Again, if I believe that there is no authorial reference, I only have to think all of your answers as correct answers, and they're your own interpretation.
So, number four and number five are actually part of the same question. In number four, the question is, in the text there, that talks about writing and reading, he says, if reading must not be context, it must remain within the text. Try to paraphrase what Derrida says. Paraphrasing is to refocus. And he says, there is nothing outside the text. And remember what we talked about regarding Barth the other day. Vicky, I can see that. What did you talk about?
We think that the only important is the text, and then the intention of the author are more important.
Okay.
The reader should focus on the text.
Okay, well, Barth was giving the reason because I don't give a damn about the author. The more or less, to talk about in plain English, there is another reason. He says, when I cannot trust the author because the author is influenced by language, by his own history. So maybe the writing that he's producing liberates itself from him because he always has a bias, he always has preconceived information. Did you talk about anything? Did you come to any conclusions? No?
No.
Okay. What about you?
The important is the text and all the environment.
Okay.
And as you said before, it wasn't there, it was the other. The death of the author means the birth of the reader.
Exactly.
Only the reader, his opinion perhaps is important.
That's the only relevant part, okay? Yes, exactly. So, with this, I don't know if Adrian, Angela, and Ricardo want to give it a try. I'll read their questions.
Okay.
Good. That way you have to put less. We're going to start with Unit 2. Unit 2 is about new historicism. Okay? New historicism is, as we were talking about before, the pillars. In the case of new historicism, we're going to challenge the interpretation of facts and how they are included in literature. Sometimes, from the point of view of creating facts from an account of elements that is closer to fiction than to fact. So, in literature, we have a very dangerous tendency. We consider the literary text as a gem. A gem, a choya, a chima. Okay? We consider the literary text to be gold. That's why we talk about universal literature. And we have the tendency to talk about any other text, any text that is coexistent, for example, a news report, for example, in the case of, I know I use Shakespeare a lot as an example, but it's very easy to refer to Shakespeare. The registration of the amount of tickets sold for the Globe in that period, a description in a history book of the type of clothes that people wore in the Jacobean period. Those type of informations are considered minor. They not provide, this is the classical point of view. Okay, so what new historicism says, so let's challenge this idea. What if the literary text isn't as important? What if we start to give the same importance to all the texts that we find from period? What if we pay attention not only to a literary account of the Vietnam War or an artistic account, but also to a news report in a period where there are news reports? What if we take into consideration a text written by the losing party of the war, and we put it at the same level? So in the first unit, we were eliminating the importance of law. We're degrading or demoting the author. In the second one, we're going to demote the text. Okay? So new historicism doesn't attack the author, it attacks the text. What are we going to do in Unit 2? In Unit 2, as usual, we're going to have a part that comes from Peter Berry's book, and that's where we're going to focus the first part of the lesson that we're going to do today. We're going to focus on Peter Berry's book on unit chapter 9, New Historicism and Cultural Materialism. We're going to see essays by Caden White, the historical text as literary artifact, and Stephen Greenblatt, Introduction to the Power of Form in the English Renaissance. This Renaissance is a Shakespearean period. It's no coincidence I'm talking about that. Afterwards, we're going to put that in practice, just like we did with Dylan Thomas's poem. We're going to read Elizabeth Bishop's Cobblepot News. And that's your homework for the next day. Okay? To take this poem and read it. You can download all of Elizabeth Bishop's poem from the virtual course, or in Unit 2, you have only Cobblepot News with a critical comment at the end, okay? So you have both options. And we're going to use as a context, which we are going to elevate to the same status as the literary text. We're going to take the literary text, and we're going to take the context, and we're going to see them in the same light, and we're going to compare them. And that's what new historicism does. That's the exercise that we're going to do in this second unit, okay? So in the first one, we question the author, and this one we're going to question, or at least we're going to bring this text down and bring this text up a bit and put them at the same level and see if that changes the narrative, because maybe it does change our perspective of how we see the reality. Okay, so in this unit 9, let me get there. New historicism and cultural materialism, I think I said it was from the 70s, it's more from the 1980s. The origin of new historicism, the origin of the name, it comes from one of the authors that we're going to read about in this unit, from Stephen Greenblatt, and his book that we're going to be part of that book, the introduction, is called Renaissance Self-Fashioning, From More to Shakespeare, From Thomas More to Shakespeare. This work is usually regarded as the starting point for new historicism. You get the page? 175, okay? Those of you at home. If we have to come to a very simple definition, we have it in the second paragraph, very cool definition. Simple definition of new historicism is a method based on parallel reading of literary and non-literary texts. So this thing that I'm going to call a co-text is a non-literary text. And my activity as a scholar is going to do parallel reading, is going to be to do parallel reading. Okay, so this is my task in this part of the course. Usually, we're going to take the literary and the non-literary text from the same period. That's the most usual approach. I don't know if you've ever seen the rewriting of some books that happened in modernism was very common. For example, there is a rewriting of Robinson Crusoe by Coetzee. It's called Foe. There is a rewriting of it's an important book. I forgot. The book about the school teacher that finds the love, but her love has a very dark story because she has an insane wife that is trapped in the attic of his house. Oh, it's so important, the book. It's a typical book from the Renaissance and it's rewritten in modern times. We're not going to get there. We'll get there. That's at a certain point. That's a word for post-colonialism. But in this first text, what we're going to do is we're going to take these universal books and you would say, oh my God, you can't do it better than this. I love this book so much. It's impossible to improve Jane Austen, for example. What about if we compare Jane Austen's book, they're super happy, super energetic, and they give you a lot of good vibes and make you believe in love again. With an account of war and how she seems to ignore that war was ravaging Europe and that the 100-year war was going on next door, that there were a lot of military conflicts for her. For Jane Austen, the figure of a soldier was only the figure of a handsome man that was a potential contender to dance with at the local ball. That's what Luciferianism is going to do. Luciferianism is going to take texts that are considered minor and are maybe used to understand the time and age of Shakespeare or Jane Austen. Or whoever it is, or Daniel Defoe, or Stevenson, and put them in context with the things that were happening at the same time, and how it fills an enormous void that we didn't even know existed. Okay, that is a void that we're trying to fill. So. The method is based on parallel reading of literary and non-literary texts, usually in the same historical period. New historicism refuses, at least ostensibly, to privilege the literary text. So we're going to remove the privileges. Okay. Angela has some answers to the previous question. Let's read that. You have to read without thinking about political ideas. All you need to know is the text where all the details are set in. Regarding number four, your answer to number four, I would not focus that only on political ideas. I would say that we have to read without taking into consideration anything. Not only the politics, the language, any type of bias that we have. Only read the text itself. Okay? So it doesn't have to do only with politics, but especially it doesn't have to, you have to read only within the text and try to forget about the external elements that Barth mentions afterwards in his work. Going back to new historicism, if we had a literary text that was a privileged text, this was in the foreground, and this was by contrast in the background. Okay, it's a bit like the old movies when you see the Wizard of Oz and you see the painted backgrounds. It's like bringing the background to the front and giving it the same importance as the story that you're telling. Okay, so what new historicism does is it eliminates these concepts that there is a literary gem, there is a privileged text, everything is a context. This is what new historicism does. It eliminates the privilege of the literary text and it brings it down to the same level as the rest of the text of the time. It envisages and practices a mode of study in which literary and non-literary texts are given equal weight and constantly inform or interrogate each other. It says later on in that paragraph, which I also think is an interesting point of view, an intensified willingness to read all of the textual traces of the past with the intention traditionally conferred only to the literary text. So what happens if we pay more attention to all the things that we were ignoring or only using as secondary references of the literary story? Maybe it's going to change our point of view of the literary story. Maybe we don't find it so universal. Okay, so that is the type of questioning that is put in practice. What this does, what new historicism does, is the following page, it embodies a paradox, and for some, a scandal. Just imagine how scholars hated post-structuralist and new historicists in this period. Normally, a scholar was a person that earned his position in the university and basically wrote about dead people to justify their salary for the rest of their lives. What if somebody came along and said, you know that dead person? Not important. So everything that a person has written about that dead person is no longer useful. What about if the person says, you know that literary text that gives a name to the subject that you teach in that university? Not important. What is important is to put it next to, I'm not going to exaggerate, but a stock list of military elements from the same period of time that your literary text you value so much was written. So these two theories are very, very anti-establishment, especially for people for an establishment that is so stable and so unwilling to accept change as the literary studies were before the 1960s. So these type of works were considered absolutely scandalous. To consider that Shakespeare is not universal, that Shakespeare is just one, just an author, and we don't even care what he's called, and to say that Hamlet is an interesting text, but there are also thousands of interesting texts from the same period of time, that's scandalous. And it also breaks one of the biggest principles that there's a literary canon. The idea that we were talking about before. If you eliminate the author, you eliminate the text as key elements of the ways of approaching literature, you're eliminating the only way that people had of categorizing what was important or what wasn't important, what everybody had to read at least once in their life, and what people could go on ignoring for the rest of their lives. You're bringing everything that's being written, everything that's been produced, whether it's literary or not, into the mix. And that's a lot of information. Okay? So that is a completely different perspective. That's why it says that it was perceived as a scandal at the moment. It is an approach to literature in which there is no privileging of the text. A new historical essay will place the literary text within the frame of a non-literary text. Thus, Greenblatt's main innovation from the viewpoint of literary study was to juxtapose the plays of the Renaissance period with the horrifying colonialist policies pursued by all the major European powers of the era. Hugh Gravey in the modernist Shakespeare draws attention to the marginalization and dehumanizing of suppressed others. Suppressed others are the people that are ignored in these stories that just create a background, sort of an exotic point of view. Okay, so if there is any civilization that is used as something to color the work, it's no longer used to color. It's used to express how important that civilization also was and how it was ignored or destroyed by the dominant civilization of the time. The analysis of a contemporary historical document overlaps in some way with the subject matter of the play in his way of approaching the analysis. Greenblatt himself refers to the appropriated historical document as the anecdote and the typical new historical essay amidst the customary academic preliminaries about previously published interpretations of the play in question. So, I don't know if you've ever read a critical essay of any kind. If you study semantics, for example, over here, it's a nightmare because basically there were literary theory or any type of linguistic or scholarly theory does is based on the study that such and such did in 1928 and based on the conclusions drawn by whoever in 1932, and also based on and refuting the context, so the preliminary the pages of essays are normally an account of everything that's been written about the same topic up to the moment, and then you add your contribution that has to be original and different and a new point of view. What new historicism says is we don't agree with your point of view and how you locate 10 literary texts and the rest of the text. We're just going to eliminate all the preliminary. We don't care what's been written about this before. Imagine how scandalous that was, because many of those authors were the colleagues of these people writing these essays. All of the preliminary discussion has been eliminated in the same way. Post-structuralism, in a certain way, are ignoring or are being respectful towards the author. In the same way, new historicism is being respected with all the rest of the scholarly work, except for other new historicist work. So it's a complicated point of view to be successful among your colleagues. Telling them, my point of view is that all your work is garbage, and now I'm going to write something that is really meaningful as a starting point. I don't think that would sit very well in any profession. No matter what, especially in the scholarly one. typically a new historical essay, did I already read that? No, I didn't.
Yes,
okay, man. Greenblatt's main innovation from the viewpoint of literary study was to juxtapose the play of the Renaissance period with the horrifying.
Yes, you are Greenblatt himself.
Okay, himself. Document as an anecdote and the typical new historicist essay amidst the customary academic preliminaries about previously published interpretations of the play in question. So, what is historicism? If there is a new historicism, there has to be old historicism. So on the next page, you have the topic new and old historicism. I don't know what we're doing on time. Okay, we've got 20 minutes. We're going to probably have time to cover most of tonight and maybe pick up in cultural materialism. I think that's really cool because, for the next day, I'm going to use another presentation that I have, similar to the one I used for the first unit that talks about new historicism and cultural materialism. Today we're going to finish the new historicism part and we're going to leave cultural materialism for the next class. What you have to read, remember, is Elizabeth Bishop's 12 o'clock news as homework for the next class. And if you can, because it's not very long, and it's included here, Mary McCarthy's report from Vietnam, to be able to use those texts when we read them together. New historicism and old historicism. There are two differences between both types. When we say that new historicism involves a parallel study of literary and non-literary texts, what we say here, the word parallel encapsulates the essential difference between this and earlier approaches to literature, which have made some use of historical data. What new historicism does is it takes this step of eliminating the importance of the literary text. These earlier approaches made a hierarchical separation between the literary text, which was the object of value, the jewel, we call it the gem, as it were, and the historical background, which was merely the second, and by definition, of lesser worth. That is the first difference. The practice of giving equal weight to literary and non-literary material is the first and major difference between new and old historicism. In the next paragraph, it says, a second important difference between old and new historicism is encapsulated in the word archival, in the phrase, the archival continuum, quoted earlier. So that word indicates that new historicism is indeed a historicist rather than a historical movement. That is, it is interested in history as represented and recorded in written documents. In history as text. And this is really interesting because, actually we have no idea of what happened earlier than everything that can be recorded, and we can have, we can make our own impression based on seeing the events. I would say, I don't know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago. Everything that we know about history, every single thing, is, we know based on an account in text of someone that says that that happened. And that's the only piece of information that we have. We don't know history. We know historicism. We know the interpretation of history as a text. And that is very important. It's a big difference. Especially if you look at any current event and how you create controversial, sometimes polarizing accounts of the same facts. The same facts seen by two different people can be absolutely contradictory about who's responsible, who's to blame, who's the victim, what is the problem, what is the cause, what is the solution, everything. So if we have the possibility of understanding that in our current times, this has probably been going on forever because, I mean, as humans, we haven't changed that much in terms of nature. And what I said at the beginning of the class, history is normally written by the victors, and they decide what gets told, what gets forgotten, and how to tell it. And maybe there are lots of parts that are factual, maybe there are some parts that are fictional, there are some parts that are subjective points of view of what happened. So that is very important to distinguish between history and historicism. That is a potential exam question. Okay, so to be able to establish those differences. Historical events as such, we would argue, are irrecoverably lost. That's what I was saying. Everything that I cannot experience on my own is lost forever. I have to believe the story that someone tells about that. For example, Romans were fantastic at recording their own history. They recorded the good things and they recorded the less good things. That's why, besides the Bible, we know a lot of facts about the period in which the Romans were in the area of Palestine, or what is nowadays Israel, and we know several points of view. We know the biblical, providential point of view, and we know the account of Roman historians. Other civilizations were not as worried in recording history, or would only record history, for example, for propaganda reasons, as a way of telling the story in a certain manner. For example, in the Second World War, it was very common not only to engage in warfare, but also to engage in propaganda war. German airplanes would fly over areas of France, throwing paper leaflets explaining, according to the Germans, the reasons for the war, the reasons for the invasion as a way of softening the people and accepting, in the case of the outcome, how the story goes. That's a way of doing historicism. That's a way of telling the story according to how you want events to go. Okay, so that is an example of historicism. The same thing there, we can see in the Vietnam War. What is the, what happened really in the Vietnam War? Should we believe the books we read about the Vietnam War? Should we believe the newspaper we read about the Vietnam War? Should we believe apocalypse now? Should we, believe, Full Metal Jacket? What is a real account? Probably somewhere in the middle. But those events, they're not forever. We just have the account of what happened there, to justify. The word replaces the world. That is a key sentence of that is in the book. The word replaces the world. We don't have the world to experience. We only have the word of what happened. Okay, so the literary text replaces the facts that happened there. Incorporated into the preference for the textual record of the past is the influence of deconstruction. So, new historicism, looks back and says, hey, remember what these guys used to do in post-structuralism? Let's bring that back, because I really like that theory. It's not that bad. So there is a deconstructive process in new historicism. Incorporating the preference of the textual record of the past is the influence of deconstruction. New historicism accepts Derrida's view that there is nothing outside the text. In the special sense, that everything about the past is only available to us in textualized form. It is thrice processed. It is processed by the ideology. It is processed by the discursive practices of the own time. And it is processed by our own view and our discursive practices. So what does that mean? There's a couple of questions. Let me go address them.
Ricardo, let's see. Okay. ¿Dónde está el texto, Ángela? No lo encuentro. Guía de estudio, página 7. Yeah, that's Derrida's text, Ricardo. And I'm reading, I read, in the first two classes, I read chapter 3 from beginning theory. Sorry, I'll give more information about that the next time I record. And in the second part, I'm reading from unit 9 of beginning theory. Okay? But only the contents of beginning theory are in the exams or the books Heart of Darkness and The Awakening too. Okay, Adrián, since we have two new students, I think it's a good moment to stop and talk about that, even if we have to pass some of the contents to the next class. Let's see, what do you need to do to pass this up, which is your biggest interest? First step is to print out the study guides. Print out all the study guides. In the study guide, the first step is going to tell you what to do. And there's normally going to be one or two critical authors. You're very lucky because when I studied this, I had to read the whole book. It was very long and very boring. Lots of pages. And I didn't understand anything. And you only have to read a passage. It's already selected and it's already inserted. So it's really, really focused on what you need to know about each of the units. There's also going to be a literary text. In the first unit, it's a poem. And in the second, it's a poem and a report. In each unit, it's only going to be different. It's all in this gray box. I'm going to show the people there. It's all in this gray box at the beginning of each unit. In this one, for example, it's Peter Berry's Chapter 9, a poem by Elizabeth Bishop, an excerpt by Mary McCarthy, and two extracts from Hayden White and Stephen Greenblatt. That's what you need to know for each of the units. But two of the units that we talked about before, the units that have to do with feminism, and the units that have to do with post-colonialism, they have like a bonus track. Okay, the bonus track is you have to read two novels. And the novels are very significant.
The good thing about this novel is that you can reuse the read in other subjects throughout English studies. So that's good. I think in gender studies you use The Awakening, and I don't remember where you use Heart of Darkness, because I studied from the Awakening study the Drago. But basically they're very important books. You should read and know them anyway. In fact, Heart of Darkness is a seminal book in according to the literary canon that we requested now, but Apocalypse Now, that I just referred to this movie, is a recreation in the times of Vietnam of the same story that Heart of Darkness is in the colonial period in the middle of Africa. So this is supposed to show that the universal elements that Heart of Darkness has and that we're going to use to study post-colonialism. How am I going to focus that? Basically, I'm going to do all the content that is theoretical, whether I skip the natural order or not, to give you as much time as possible to read The Awakening and to read Heart of Darkness. The Awakening is available for free on the internet, but I really recommend you to buy a critical edition because it's short and it has some of the critical editions are very good. Heart of Darkness is the same. You can read one of the annotated versions, very good. Both of them are available as audiobooks. If you, for example, if you travel because you commute to work in the mornings and you have a lot of free time that you don't know how to use. What I used to do when I had to read so much is I listened to the books. At the same time, I read them if I was on the train, exactly. Or I listened to some parts and I read others and I went faster. They're both on the website paperbox.org. It's a non-profit website that records voluntarily audiobooks of the classics, not only in English, in all languages. But you have a lot of books in English that you can use in your studies. Those are the books that we need. I'm going to do the post-structuralist unit, the new historicist unit. I'm going to deal with the theory of feminism. I'm going to deal with the theory of racial inequality, the theory of queer theory. And then I'm going to see The Awakening. So I think we should be around December, maybe there. So by December, you should have read The Awakening. I'll go over post-colonialism, and when I finish, I'll start with Heart of Darkness. So I want to give you as much time as possible. If you have to start reading The Awakening. That's the initial book. Let me see if there's any other questions. Angela left. Have I answered your questions, guys? I don't know if I've answered your questions. Maybe you can answer there. Did you know this, Andrea and Padre Emilio? Did you know about these two books that you had to read? No, you didn't know. Okay, so that's very important to start reading as soon as possible The Awakening. And maybe over Christmas you can finish Heart of Darkness. I'm going to try to do first The Awakening and then Heart of Darkness. Okay. Did you understand? Any questions?
Can you write the name of the page where you can hear?
Oh, yes. Super cool page. It's one of those, you have to bookmark this one. This is one of my favorite pages. If you're on a student budget and you don't have money to buy books, you can probably download, both books from gutenberg.org. The text of the books, for example, if you have a Kindle reader, you can probably download a Kindle version or an online version that you can read on your phone. Gutenberg.org has every book that is in the public domain. Every book that doesn't have a copyright, like the Mickey Mouse Law, for example, it's called the Mickey Mouse Law because they changed the amount of years of the copyright to protect Walt Disney. That's why it's called like that. So for example, this year, last year in January, it was the last year when the work of Federico Arteaga was copyrighted. And now you can find all the work of Federico Garcia Lorca, you can like get my work. You can read all of Federico Lorca on goodlibrary.org. People volunteer to read books out loud and record them as MP3s on LibriVox.org. LibriVox.org is a fantastic website where you can download the full version of millions of books. George Orwell's books, for example, or, for example, what we have here, all of the work of Keshe Fan is the author of The Awakening, fantastic American author, one of my personal favorites, and this work and other works are recorded on LibriVox.org. You can download them for free. Okay? And, I don't know if I've answered everybody's question. Okay, good. Any other questions? No? No? Okay. You can, if I speak very fast, you didn't understand me, you're very shy, you don't want to ask questions in class, send me an email, okay? Yeah.
I think that the question that I don't know who made was if only we have to, for the exam, for the part B, it's necessary all the refusal and all the, or
yes.
Only the two books.
No,
everything.
Yes, yes.
Okay, I think that the question was...
I can't show you now. Next week I'll show you a couple of examples so you see what type of questions you face. One of the things that many of you, this is your first year at the NET.
I already
know. The most important thing at the NET, this is the key to success, this is a secret recipe, this is a Kentucky Fried Chicken recipe, is download exams. You have to understand what is going to be asked in every subject. You study in terms of what you find as a difficulty. Once you understand the way the exam works, you're going to be successful because you're going to focus the way you study towards a passing exam, not a learning everything in the book, not learning all the details. You have to know what type of questions are asked. Okay? That's the key to success in life. Okay? And I studied this to do that here. That's my job. Next week I'll show you where to download the exams from, okay? There's a website specifically for the exams. Thank you very much. See you next week, okay? Angela, come to class. Stop connecting from home. See you. Okay, let me stop this. Ya estoy. Yo te la pido.